Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. What was the worst thing you ever did as a teenager? Don't worry, you don't have to answer that. I certainly don't intend to. But did you ever get into deep trouble as a teenager just because of the music you listened to? Later in the show, we'll talk to the director of the documentary, Teenage, which is all about the advent of the whole idea of being a teenager. It's a surprisingly recent concept. And we'll hear about, among other things, how teenagers in Germany during the Second World War could get into some serious trouble just because of the music they listened to or the way they dressed. The leader of the Brooklyn-based pop band, Elizabeth and the Catapult, Elizabeth Zeman, tells us about how she got into trouble with her own mom when she wore sweatpants to play guitar in a subway stop. She and her band will play some songs from their latest album, Like It Never Happened, here in the studio. And this being radio, we don't judge her for how she chooses to dress today. But first, the story of a very important singer who had his first massive hit when he was just a teenager. He may not be a household name, but the late Alex Chilton sure does get a lot of attention, starting with this song called Alex Chilton by the Minnesota alternative band The Replacements. He's also been name-checked by R.E.M. and Wilco. There's a recent documentary film about his band from the 70s called Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. Alex Chilton's status as an underground music icon is reaffirmed again in Holly George Warren's book, A Man Called Destruction, The Life and Music of Alex Chilton, From Box Tops to Big Star to Backdoor Man. Holly joins me once again in the Soundcheck studio. Good to see you.
Great to be back, John.
So the book is called A Man Called Destruction. Was there a kind of self-destructive streak to this very gifted musician?
Well, actually, the title comes from an album that Alex did in 1995, A Man Called Destruction. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think more in terms, especially as I did other research on the book and just listening to Alex's music again, that it's kind of more in line of, to paraphrase Picasso, to create, you first must destroy. And I think it's really, Alex had a very restless artistic spirit. He didn't want to stick with one kind of music. He was a voracious lover of all genres of music, both in the music that he sang and wrote himself, but also what he liked to listen to and then cover. So it's really more that he didn't want to be categorized or, you know, he didn't want to be the big star guy. He didn't want to be the Box Tops lead singer guy. He really liked being this eclectic, kind of unpredictable artist.
Well, he did start. I mean, this is like, you know, as opposed to rags to riches, his story is the reverse. He starts right out of the gate with a huge number one hit song and then seems to spend the rest of his career kind of disassembling the mechanism that made him a star in the first place.
Yeah, timing was kind of everything. You know, he was just barely 16 when he sang The Letter in this very great Memphis studio, American Recording Studio. And the Box Tops, I mean, the group itself didn't even have that name, the Box Tops, yet. Alex was completely unprepared for being thrown out into the world of stardom. He dropped out of school in 10th grade to go on the road and basically spent the next almost 3 years constantly touring. A lot of people thought, you know, he was like a 40-year-old black man, you know, instead of this 16-year-old white kid from Memphis.
Let's hear the song that made 16-year-old Alex Chilton an international celebrity, the song from the Box Tops called The Letter.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spare. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. When she wrote me a letter, said she couldn't back to my baby once more. Anyway, yeah, got me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a going home. My baby used to whip me a letter.
1967, the Box Tops number one hit, The Letter, featuring Alex Chilton, 16 years old at the time, out of Memphis. He is the subject of Holly George Warren's latest book called A Man Called Destruction, The Life and Music of Alex Chilton, from Box Tops to Big Star to Backdoor Man. Yeah, you mentioned a moment ago, Holly, that kind of gravelly, much older sounding voice, which is not the voice he would then use once he became Alex Chilton, or, you know, led any of his various other bands. So we're talking about a guy who bursts on the scene, you know, international success, and then proceeds to follow it up with a couple of, you know, other singles that do well, and then goes through this kind of steady process for the rest of his career of kind of reinventing himself, each time a little bit further removed from popularity and celebrity and stuff. Did you get the impression that this was a conscious choice on his part? Was it few? I mean, I lost track of how many times he talks about taking pills and being totally drunk and stuff.
Well, Alex really had to follow his muse. He had to do the kind of music that spoke to him, that he felt like doing at the time. It didn't matter if it was out of vogue with what was cool, you know? And what's interesting about Alex's musical choices is a lot of the music that he ended up being engaged in was really ahead of its time. I mean, people made fun of him doing Volare and stuff. Hey, a few years later, there was this lounge music craze. You know, Americana music, which is huge now. I'll tell you something. When I heard his much maligned, which I loved, like Flies on Sherbert, which came out in the late 70s, he was doing Carter Family, Cajun, R&B, blues, you know, really vernacular American music, kind of deconstructed.
And if he had done that 20 years later,
it would be huge.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing with lo-fi, you know, he was recording these lo-fi records that, of course, later Pavement and all these indie rock bands were embracing that style. So part of it was that I think Alex just followed his own vision and did the kind of music he wanted to do. And of course, when Big Star got back together in the 90s, he could have easily cashed in and recorded a Big Star-ish kind of album for a major label, but he refused to do that.
Yeah. All right. Now, since you've mentioned Big Star, and since Big Star is the band upon which Alex Chilton's legend rests, let's talk about that group. Here we go from the gravelly lower voice singer of the Box Tops to this kind of higher tenor in the band Big Star. And as you're saying, you know, he's often ahead of the curve. The funny thing with Big Star is they were right at the peak of the curve. If you listen to the sound with those Beatles-esque harmonies, and we're talking early 70s, this should have been a massively successful band.
Well, unfortunately, there was another big trend in the early 70s, and I grew up in North Carolina, not too far from Memphis, and kind of the heavy, you know, blues rock, Humble Pie, and of course Led Zeppelin,
Mountain,
Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
You know, that was huge. And then, of course, the whole prog rock thing. Yes, Emerson, Lake & Palmer. So, you know, people were trying to, you know, FM, you know, radio that was starting to happen in the larger, you know, markets was kind of embracing that kind of style, whereas AM was still playing the more poppy kind of stuff. So with Big Star, they really didn't fit into any kind of category. And then, of course, they had horrible luck with record label distribution and all these kind of things that were going on, you know, behind the scenes that affected the distribution of those records.
So when Alex Chilton and Company released their first album as Big Star in 1972, it's called Number One Record. A title that would turn out to be quite ironic for a record that, as you say, had real problems just getting into the stores. People liked it. They just couldn't buy it.
Exactly.
They couldn't
find it. I mean, critics raved about it. It got, you know, wonderful reviews and everything from Rolling Stone to Billboard. But, you know, sure enough, people couldn't find the records.
The song In the Street comes from that record by the band Big Star. Big Star featuring Alex Chilton and a song called In the Street from their 1972 debut Number One record. For a guy who knew all about Number One records from his time with the Box Tops, how did he respond to the challenge, Holly, of being, you know, in a band that was not, that was getting the critical acclaim but wasn't getting the popular response?
Well, in the beginning, Alex, I don't think, was that upset about it because he was already used to the ups and downs of the record business. He kind of knew what it was all about. His partner in songwriting and lead vocals, however, Chris Bell, was just completely devastated by the lack of success. He just knew it was going to be a huge smash and all this kind of thing. And that disappointment really took its toll on Chris Bell's outlook on life mm-hmm. and mental state. And he eventually left the band not too long after the record came out. He was also getting a little resentful about the fact that they were getting media coverage in the press and they were all centering around Alex and calling it Alex's band and all this kind of thing. And that's because, you know, as some journalists happen to do, they, you know, try to peg things on a known name. And since right. Alex was known from, you know, back in the Box Tops days and had actually gotten, even in the New Yorker, Ellen Willis had written about this great young singer of the Box Tops. So he'd gotten critical respect even when they were in that teeny bopper so-called world. So Chris just couldn't take it anymore and quit the band.
And it really was Chris's band before Alex came along, but then Chris leaves and it does, in fact, become Alex Chilton's
That's
band.
That's correct. Yeah, it becomes a three-piece with Jody Stevens on drums and Andy Hummel on bass, the original components of the
and
band.
And they release another album called Radio City, which includes this Big Star classic called September Girls. It is a 1974 album by Big Star, led by singer and songwriter Alex Chilton. The album called Radio City. The song is called September Girls. My guest is Holly George Warren, who's done a lot of music writing over the years. Her latest book is out now. It's called A Man Called Destruction, The Life and Music of Alex Chilton, From Box Tops to Big Star to Backdoor Man. And, you know, you listen to that song and those jangly guitars, and 30 years later, that would be the sound of Brooklyn indie rock. And here's this guy doing it in Memphis in the early 1970s.
I know. It was, I mean, it's the perfect pop song. It's just like a crime that that song was not a hit in its day. But funnily enough, Alex said something to the effect that, well, you know, maybe if Big Star had been a big hit then, you know, and we scored with September Girls, it wouldn't be so revered today. People wouldn't care so much about the band today. And it was like this little secret treasure.
Let's go back to the third album. And, you know, again, there's no distribution and Alex gives it up as a bad job.
They couldn't even get a record label to put it out.
So he comes to New York City and it's the mid-70s and punk is in full flower. And here's Alex Chilton, ex-pop star from the Box Tops, this kind of early proto-alt rocker from Big Star, and now he's here in New York working with bands like The Cramps. Yet another reinvention.
Yeah, he loved the punk scene and was pretty much a regular at CBGB's. Kind of, that was back when they even had a little kitchen. He even ate there. And Max's and really was part of that scene. He discovered The Cramps and went nuts over them. And said, I want to produce y'all, you know, I'll come down to Memphis with me. I can get you free studio time. I mean, he was this enthusiastic music lover. When he found something that he liked it all the way. Some of those stories behind the working together with the Cramps was my favorite part of researching the book because there are just so many funny misadventures with those guys.
And, you know, for someone who, as you said before, was very early on a fan of Americana, hearing the rockabilly sound of bands like The Cramps, you know, he would have He would have seen past the veneer of, oh, this is brand new, this punk thing, to see the musical roots that were there.
Yeah, he loved that primal, psychobilly, as a lot of people call the Cramps music that they were doing, where it's all about the emotion and the rhythm. And, you know, Lux Interior was this amazing front man that I think really was inspirational to Alex, too.
And if you listen to some of Alex's own music from that time, there's this one-off single called Bangkok.
That single.
From 1977. This is Alex Chilton in New York.
It's a little thing that's gonna please ya. Just a little town down in Indonesia, Bangkok. Bangkok. Two smutty-eyed men lying in bed. One got his mouser, the other said Bangkok. Making love the Japanese way. I learned aggressively in Hong Kong, Bangkok. Bangkok. Margaret Trudeau, Jackie O.
That is such a politically incorrect song.
I know.
There's so much wrong with that song. First of all, Bangkok is not in Indonesia. It's in Thailand. But that's Alex Chilton, not caring.
Yes.
And Holly mentioned meeting him on the streets in New Orleans in 1982. He would eventually produce your band a couple of years later. He goes to New Orleans to basically, what, clean up, get his act together, work with his hands?
Unbelievably, in the land of drive-through, you know, cocktail lounges and things like that, he went to New Orleans to quit drinking, which he successfully did, just to show the guy, when he set his mind to something, he could do it.
Yeah. And then in the 80s, his name begins to spread. We heard earlier The Replacements, you know, doing their song called Alex Chilton. So he begins to figure into the mythology, the creation myth of a lot of the first kind of alternate or underground rock bands of the late 80s, early 90s. As the 90s go on, how did he feel about the possibility of, you know, Alex Chilton as a rock star, you know, people coming to see, wanting to see big star reunions, et cetera?
Alex was not a big fan of fame. He didn't like the trappings. He hated, you know, adulation and that kind of thing. He wanted respect, of course, and he wanted to make a decent living as a musician. And that's kind of where the backdoor man part of the story comes in. He was very happy to be able to make a good living for a change, literally touring the country with a trio and playing the songs that he wanted to play. He'd throw in once in a while, a big star song, a box top song. He would do that in the early days, in the 80s and the 90s, when he was out touring. And as artists started covering his songs, he enjoyed cashing those checks. So he really had finally a successful, you know, musician life happening in the late 80s. But he had kind of at that point realized that, you know, trying to go for another hit was pretty much, you know, not going to happen if he wanted to play the kind of music that he wanted to do. I mean, yes, people would have probably given him a big advance to go into the studio and do big star type songs, but he wasn't interested in doing that kind of music
for a whole album. And he was always, as you write numerous times in the book, he was always doing covers of other people's songs. And that would always, that seemed to be like part and parcel of who Alex Chilton was.
Yeah, it was imprinted on him, you know, as a kid in the Moondogs when he was, you know, his first ever garage band, even before the DeVilles, which became the Box Tops. You know, doing cover songs was always the thing to do. And that's how he learned to play music. He learned all these songs that his dad had in his big record collection, you know, Chet Baker songs, Ray Charles songs. He'd always been the sponge soaking up music, and he had this incredible memory for music. Mm-hmm. He remembered songs that, you know, he would just pull them out of a hat. It was incredible.
I got it bad for the new girl in school. The guys are flipping, but I'm playing it cool. Everybody's passing notes in class. They really dig her now, she's such a gas. I got it bad for the new girl in school. The chicks are jealous of the new girl in school. They put her down and they treat her so cruel. But the guys are going out of their minds, 'cause she's the finest.
But he did eventually reform a kind of version of Big Star. And for a guy who was so uncomfortable with fame, and I don't want to be glib here, but his final act, you know, passing away while the band is waiting for him on the huge national stage of South by Southwest, the South by Southwest Fest. It was like one final way in which Alex Chilton cheats fame.
Exactly. And I mean, it wasn't the first time the new Big Star had played at South by Southwest. And Alex, I had seen all of those shows at South by. And in fact, I was there and heard the devastating news of his passing. And my first thought was like, oh, maybe it's a hoax. You know, maybe Alex is just trying to get out of coming to South by. He decided he was going to blow it off. And he's, you know, putting this fake news item out there. But it came to be, you know, horribly true. But it is interesting because that South by Southwest of 2010, it really was like a 4-day wake for Alex. Yep. I mean, everybody from, you know, Ray Davies to Courtney Love to John Hyatt. I mean, I was going to shows still, even though I was so brokenhearted. Everybody was doing a shout out to Alex, Cheap Trick. I mean, almost every major artist there was remembering Alex. So if the kids at South by that year didn't know who he was, they certainly did by the end of it.
Right. Because everybody was playing his songs. I mean, you mentioned Cheap Trick, who had, of course, a huge hit with a cover of one of Alex's tunes. So he dies in 2010. The book is out now. What is the prospect for yet another kind of revival of interest in Big Star and maybe even the later Alex Chilton material?
Well, I really hope my book brings to people's attention all the diversity of his music because, you know, there's like the Big Star camp and there's the Box Tops camp and then there's the Alex Solo Years camp and the, you know, kind of Tav Falco, Panther Burns Alex camp,
right,
you know,
right, right.
Which we didn't have a chance to talk about. But, you know, a lot of people only know about a certain fragment of his music. And the guy was just, you know, he was this multifaceted artist. And I think it would be really cool for people to learn about all these different styles that he did and find a lot of beauty in his work in all kinds of directions.
Holly George Warren is the author of A Man Called Destruction, The Life and Music of Alex Chilton, From Box Tops to Big Star to Backdoor Man. Holly, it's always a pleasure to have you with us on Soundcheck. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you so much for playing these great tunes, and I just can't ever get enough of Alex Chilton's music.
Well, here's a little more from the 1995 album called A Man Called Destruction.
Capricorn, Sagittarius, Aquarius, Pisces, Gemini, Aries, Scorpio, Libra, Virgo, Taurus, Cancer, Leo. What's your sign, girl?
Up next, live music from the Brooklyn pop band Elizabeth and the Catapult. And later, what is a teenager? The maker of a documentary about teens helps define a surprisingly murky and recent term. That's coming up. This is Soundcheck.
Making rabbits with the salt of the earth. I'm making rabbits with the salt of the earth. Where did you go? You're digging underground. I gotta hunt you down. I gotta hunt you down.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Classical training and a keen ear for pop come together in the songs of pianist and songwriter Elizabeth Zeman. The latest album from her band, Elizabeth and the Catapult, includes a couple of guests. On this track, some of the stomping percussion is being done by actress Maggie Gyllenhaal and her daughter. It's just one of many surprising moments on the record, which is called Like It Never Happened. Elizabeth and the Catapult are here in the Soundcheck studio to play some songs from it, beginning with this one called Happy Pop.
Song. I think I heard it once before. I think I wrote it in my sleep last night. Before
for I knew what it was written for. Here's my happy pop song for my future kids to sing. I think I wrote it in my sleep last night. It's got no purpose, got no need. Church Avenue and nobody, nobody, nobody. God bless you, little India, 'cause you're always blessing me. Even giving me a dollar, even when you weren't
for a self-described happy pop song. It certainly has an ambiguous ending. That is Elizabeth and the Catapult, live on Soundcheck. The song, Happy Pop, is the lead-off track on the newest album from the band. It's called Like It Never Happened. As always, Elizabeth and the Catapult is led by Elizabeth Zeman. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth at our piano. Adam Minkoff will be playing bass and guitar, but was doing some percussion on that piece. John O'Linden on guitar, David Heilman behind our drum kit. The strings, Melissa Tong and Katie Kresick playing violins, Dave Fallow playing the viola. So, Elizabeth, on the record, as usual, you're playing piano, but you're also playing a lot of guitar on this record, too.
Yes.
When did you learn that?
After I was dropped from my last label, which is what I'm singing about.
In that song, yes.
So that's a good transition. I went to, I was hanging out with some friends that were busking a lot in the subways of Brooklyn, and I realized that... it was a really great way to play for an anonymous crowd and test out new songs. So I started learning the guitar, and I ended up writing most of this album, actually, on the subway.
So yeah. There's a line in the song that refers to playing on the platform at Church Avenue.
Yeah, that's in I'm giving away my secret.
Is that a particularly good place?
It's a really great place to play. It's Little India in Brooklyn, and there's very few people that pass by. Once in a while, I don't make a lot of money.
Mm.
Yesterday, I think I made 3 pennies from a small child and maybe $2 other. But once in a while, someone will bless me if I'm playing a really upbeat song or a happy song.
And would you consider Happy Pop to be an upbeat, happy song?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, a little.
It's a little ambiguous. But, you know, my last record that actually you commissioned a lot of the songs for, thank you,
The Other Side of Zero,
yes.
Yeah.
That was kind of a breakup album where I came from it, you know, kicking and screaming. But this record was it was a label breakup album, and it was a lot more playful and humorous. Like, we both knew that it was the right thing to do.
Both you and
the label.
The label knew that it was time to part ways. New label then, new instrument for the songwriting process. Did that spark something, that change of instrument, getting away from the piano so much?
I think so. There's definitely a certain freedom that's created from writing on such a rhythmic instrument,
something that's
so primitive. It might have something to do with the fact that I'm also not a great guitar player yet. but I think it frees up the melody and the lyrics in a big way.
Right.
But yeah, this album, even the process of making it was so different because of the way that it was released. I have a distribution company, 30 Tigers, but I really released the album with the help of my fans with Pledge Music.
Right.
So the whole process was, I was very connected the whole time, and there was a lot of give and take between the fans.
Nice.
But
none of those fans ride the subways, apparently? No one ever recognized you while you were busking?
I think that I've actually only been recognized once by my mom. And I didn't tell her to stop. And I think she really didn't like that I was there. She was very embarrassed.
So mom's just taking the subway, minding her own business, and there's her daughter Elizabeth sitting on the platform playing the guitar.
She told me to wear something different next time.
That sounds like a mom. What were you wearing?
I was just, you know, I was wearing sweatpants and a huge puffy coat.
It's also a different catapult with you
yes.
here today. Although, you know, Dan Malott and Peter Lalish, who had been with you, they're on this new record too. So obviously there's still stuff happening with them.
Yeah, I was first going to record the record with Richard Swift, who I met
from
back
the Shins.
Yes. He wasn't actually in the Shins when I met him.
Back then, yeah.
A couple years ago, I met him backstage at a Bright Eyes show, and I'm a super fan of Richard Swift. I know every word to every one of his songs. And my belt popped off onto him. I was that excited. It was like one of those slide-on American
I don't know what that means.
It means there was excitement.
And your belt popped off.
And I made an impression.
I'm sure you did.
And so I sent him my music, and he was totally down to record this record. And then he soon after joined the Shins and was on the road so much that I just kept sending him songs over the years. And finally, Danny reached out to me and just said, you know, I miss making music with you. I miss recording. So it was, I ended up doing both records. I made this record, and then I went and did an EP with Richard.
Okay, which will be coming out later.
Yes.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Zeman and hearing her band, Elizabeth and the Catapult. What's Maggie Gyllenhaal doing on your record?
Oh, I teach piano. So this is actually a strange story, but I was teaching her for a part in a movie, and then she ended up playing the zither or something instead. And I ended up teaching her kid. So by the time we were recording the record, we were recording in a studio right across the street. And so she just came over and danced, stomped and clapped.
With her daughter.
Yes.
Nice.
Ramona.
And that is not your only kind of brush with Hollywood stardom, because Anne Hathaway has cast you in a film that she's doing about New York musicians?
Yes. That was a surprise to me, too. she heard my last record and liked the song Thank You for Nothing. And when she was shooting her famous scene in Les Mis,
the haircut scene,
she had Thank You for Nothing playing in her ear to just calm her down. While they were cutting off her hair. And I didn't find out about it through her. I found out about it through fans in England that saw her talking about it in an English documentary. So then, I guess about 6 months later, I was called in for a casting call for this movie, not knowing it had anything to do with Anne Hathaway, and she was kind enough to let me play some accordion on the subway in her music.
All right. You want to play another song for us?
I would love to.
Here is another performance of a song called Shoelaces from Elizabeth and the Catapult live on Soundcheck.
Trust you if I can't tidy up my shell. How can I love you?
Elizabeth and the Catapult, live on Soundcheck with Shoelaces, another track from the band's latest album called Like It Never Happened. We're going to wrap up by hearing Elizabeth and the Catapult in their version of True Love Will Find You in the End. The album's called Like It Never Happened. It is out now. And Elizabeth, great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Don't be sad, I know you will. And
Don't give up until true love will find you in the end. 'Cause this is a meeting with a cat.
Coming up, we talk to the director of a recent film about teenagers and learn about how that idea has changed over time. This is Soundcheck.
I'm past the stage of doll and carriage. I'm not the age to think of marriage. I'm too old for toys, and I'm too young for boys. I'm just an in-between.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This might be hard to imagine, but there was a time, not too long ago, when teenagers didn't exist. Yes, of course, there were people between the ages of 13 and 19, but when Judy Garland sang this song, In Between, at the age of 16 in 1938, the term teenager hadn't yet entered the world's vocabulary. Matt Wolff is the director of a new documentary called Teenage that explores how the concept of teenagers came about. And he's with me today here in the Soundcheck studio. Matt, good to see you.
Hey, good to see you.
So your film begins in 1904,
correct,
which is when the term adolescence is coined.
Yes.
By this psychologist G. Stanley Hall. How big a step was that to recognize that there was some kind of intermediate stage between childhood and adulthood?
It was a huge thing. It really came with the abolition of child labor. You know, before you were just a child and then you'd go to work like an adult. But when youth stopped working, there was all of a sudden this second stage of life. And young people had a lot of time on their hands and they were getting into trouble. So all of a sudden, youth became a kind of social problem.
Hmm.
And forever after, adults have been trying to figure out what to do with them.
Which very often involves sending them off to war.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, both world wars figure very prominently in the development of the teenager. But your film, first of all, is based on this book by John Savage, who wrote a couple of really important histories of punk and stuff like that.
Yeah.
His book was called Teenage, The Creation of Youth Culture, 1875 to 1945. And that seems to have spawned a rather unusual kind of movie-making on your part.
Yeah, I mean, what I felt like when I read John Savage's book, Teenage, is that he was treating early 20th century through his own punk lens. And it kind of made me think, well, what if I made a historical documentary that kind of departed from the PBS and Ken Burns style and did something more experimental? And that's what we were inspired to do.
Mm-hmm. So you had actual footage from the early 20th century, but then there are also all of these recreations, many of which are kind of hard to distinguish from the real thing.
Yeah. I wanted to bring to life these hidden histories of and these forgotten adolescent figures. And I did so in the style of period home movies and newsreels. And to me, these four characters I focus on, they form almost a composite portrait of the teenager that was about to be born.
Yeah, they're almost like a Greek chorus, you know, sort of commenting on the development of what would become teenage culture.
Exactly.
And they come from three different countries, the U.S., Great Britain, and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Why those three?
Well, those three countries had competing definitions and ideas about youth. In America, youth was evolving as a democratic consumer, and ultimately the teenager was an American invention at the end of World War II. Germany had a different model. Youth were regimented and militarized. Hitler is very key to this story because he both empowered youth to be at the center of his political movement, but of course destroyed them and sacrificed them. England is a really important part of the story because it was the gateway of American popular culture and youth culture into Europe.
And there's a key moment early in the film. This takes place right after World War I. Listen to this. It's a clip from the movie Teenage.
They call us flappers, flaming youth. The times have made us awfully experienced for our age.
I got all the new jazz records. My mum thought it was awful noise. She asked me why it was good, and I said, because it comes from America.
Because it comes from America. That was all it took. And then there's another moment, I think it's in the World War II part of the film, Matt, where someone says, You know, then the GIs came and we felt like we had been living in black and white and they were living in color.
Yeah, it's an amazing line. It's a real quote from a teenager from that time.
So the idea, first of all, in the background of that clip that we just heard, that's music by Bradford Cox, right?
Yeah.
From the band Deer Hunter.
Yes. I had this premise. I wanted to combine archival imagery with contemporary music because it's really transformative. Instead of it feeling stodgy, like these are the clothes and dances my grandparents would have done, it makes you see yourself in the material. I could have been that flapper kid.
Right. So Bradford does a great job, but so does your sound designer, because a lot of your found footage would have been silent.
Exactly. And my sound designer, Mark Phillips, literally brought this archival footage to life, creating impressionistic sounds, but also literal illustrations of footage from the past.
All right. So what is it about youth in America that they become this kind of infection of the youth, first in the UK and then eventually even to Germany after the horrors of World War II?
Well, I think it's really during World War II that adolescent girls started to have this kind of power as a demographic. They were earning their own money and they started to get their own cosmetics, magazines, clothes. And it was a full-fledged youth culture and a consumer culture, and they were teenagers.
And how important was music in the spread of this?
It was critical. I would say that swing and jitterbugging was the first full-fledged youth culture.
And it's interesting that it's music with its roots in Black America.
Totally.
And one of the narrators, who is a Black American, he's quoted as saying, "Our music went where we couldn't."
Adults weren't ready to integrate, but jitterbugs were. White kids took their cues from us Negroes. Where we couldn't go, our songs would. Our music made the feet of the world dance.
I was fascinated by the jitterbugs. I could totally see myself being part of that and being one of them. And it's also something that started with, it had its origins in Black culture, and then it became a youth phenomenon, but then the mass media caught on, and it became this bigger thing that spread to Europe, and it took on this kind of political dimension for youth abroad.
Now, that is one of the most chilling parts of the film. And again, the movie is called Teenage. Matt Wolff is the director of it. When you get to the German kids listening to swing music and jitterbugs, you're talking about a group of kids who can be arrested and eventually even killed for being teenagers and for listening to this music.
Exactly. It's the point in the story of youth where politics and pop culture collide. And it's chilling because young people were doing what they do, smuggling in swing records from America, British fashion, and having these underground parties. But they were risking their lives, and it was this subversive form of rebellion against the Nazi regime.
There's also a moment in the film where someone in authority in Germany says, "Any sentence that begins with Duke Ellington ends with an assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler."
I know. Yeah, it's chilling.
And they seem to really believe that.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy.
There's an interesting parallel that you make between the CCC, this kind of outdoorsy American group, very Boy Scouty, you know, let's go out and rebuild Yellowstone Park kind of thing here in the States, and the Hitlerjugend, the Hitler Youth in Germany, where both begin as kind of ways of bringing teens together, giving them something to do. They've got some discipline. And then on the one hand, it kind of goes off the rails in a really horrible way.
Yeah. I mean, it was really about showing these competing models of dealing with youth. During the economic collapse of the Great Depression, the government had to get involved and provide some solutions. In America, it was through the CCC that young people got jobs and were earning a paycheck. In Germany, youth were put at the center of a new political plan. They were leading themselves, and they would go out into nature like Boy Scouts. What was also happening is that they were being indoctrinated and militarized.
Now, at what point does commerce, you know, the commercial world, begin to think, hey, there's this whole new group of people? They're not kids anymore, but they're not yet fully in the workforce. We got to sell to these people.
Well, it happens during World War II. Parents are away. Women are working more than they ever have been before, and young people have time again on their hands, and they're getting into trouble, and it comes with a new term, juvenile delinquency. Mm-hmm. And out of that comes a desire to form solutions. But also young people are working, they're earning their own paychecks, and they want to be treated like equals. And as a result, marketers see them as an opportunity, not just as a problem, and they start creating magazines, cosmetics, clothes, and teenage girls especially become a powerful consumer demographic.
And there's a brief scene of a Frank Sinatra concert and, you know, the teenage girls like weeping and fainting and all this kind of stuff. So most of them would have gone out and bought their own tickets with their own money at that point.
Exactly. It's a real precursor to Beatlemania.
Yeah. We're speaking with Matt Wolff, the director of the new documentary called Teenage, based on John Savage's 2007 book, Teenage, The Creation of Youth Culture, 1875 to 1945. John Savage's book ends in 1945. Your film kind of ends around the same point for one particular reason. That's when the manifesto comes out and we get the word teenager, right?
Yeah, the idea of the teenager had been percolating in culture for a long time, but it crystallized with the publication of an article called The Teenage Bill of Rights in the New York Times. It was almost like the Ten Commandments or a constitution for youth that really said, hey, this is a distinct social class and they deserve rights as anybody else would.
Each generation feels that it is the future.
To the teenager, nothing is more important
than to find out where we fit in relation to life around us.
It is a serious quest, often a painful one.
That's a moment in the film Teenage that deals with the kind of turning point, the coining of the terms teenage and teenager. This article by Elliot Cohen in the New York Times called The Teenage Bill of Rights. And Matt, one of the things you point out in the movie Teenage, in the subsequent to hearing about this manifesto, is that Elliot Cohen was basically writing about 16 to 24-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't literal teenagers, 13 to 19. It was sort of like people who'd gone through puberty but had not yet sort of fully entered what would be the main path of their adult life, I guess.
Yeah, youth was regarded as a distinct stage of life rather than a specific age. And I think a lot of the youth cultures we profiled, like the bright young people in the 1920s, are a reflection of that. They're certainly youth culture. They're about identifying youth with the future or idealizing or condemning youth. But the age bracket is a little broader.
Yeah. And so eventually, those people who are younger than 16, we eventually come up with a word for them too. And not too long ago, tweens.
Exactly.
So is this like yet another wave of kind of marketing and commercial-driven naming of a stage of life?
Yeah, these generational brackets like millennials or tweens, I see them all as kind of marketing mojo.
But they do have something behind. I mean, certainly teenager dumb is different from any other point in your life.
Yeah, and I think the generation gap keeps evolving, getting narrower and wider depending on the circumstances of the given era.
Right. So you make a movie. It's called Teenage. It's about the rise of teenage culture. You get to 1945 and, you know, what we know now as teenage culture is just beginning to explode. Why stop there?
Well, I see it as a story that ends with a beginning, in a sense. I was really interested in this notion of a prehistory, uncovering these hidden histories of youth. We've all seen punks and hippies and skaters. It's about finding the kernels of those youth cultures and identifying the dynamics adults and youth have and how they create a kind of rebellion that's meaningful.
Now, what are those kernels? I mean, are they the same germs of teenage behavior now that they were in the 40s and the 20s and the teens?
I think so. I think it's a desire by adults to control youth because they represent the future, and a desire amongst young people to create their own destiny and to imagine the future on their own terms. And that tension creates a lot of interesting and generative things.
Mm. The interesting thing is, you know, how important music was for the development of this teenage culture. And it was noted really early on. Back in the 20s and 30s, you have people talking about it. And it wasn't until recently that neuroscientists began to realize that there's something in the brain, in the teenage brain, that, one, you know, the music that you absorb when you're 14, 15, 16 has a really kind of formative impact and stays with you the rest of your life.
Totally. I relate to that emotionally. I remember the records I listened to as a teenager and they still have that emotional impact, but I think there is real science behind that.
Yeah. And yet somehow people sort of intuited it many, many years earlier.
Yeah, and I think young people get passionate about music and turn something that's small and underground into something that's mass culture.
Mm-hmm. So is that what we're talking about at the end of the day when we talk about teenage culture? Are we talking about marketing and, you know, a target demographic for people to sell to?
Well, I think there's always young people who are doing something different, something independent, that are discovering a new language and creating their own vocabulary to express themselves. Unfortunately, these days, marketers kind of catch on to that quickly and send it right back to youth. But I think that cycle of innovation is always there.
The film is called Teenage, directed by Matt Wolf, who's been with me here in the Soundcheck studio. Matt, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for Soundcheck today. The program is produced at WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl and our interns Haley Shaw and Micah Lowinger. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.